From the island in Bellows Falls, you're listening to WOOL.
You're listening to WOOL Black Sheep Radio on 91.5 FM, Sea Realm Radio with KMO.
Hello, Bellows Falls. I'm KMO. This is Sea Realm Radio. We have a gray, chilly, windy day here in Bellows Falls, and I'm afraid it's just not going to get much better than that in the coming weeks and months. So it goes. But at least you are in a warm spot, at least I hope so, and you are listening to a great radio station, so good on you. And on the line I have James Felton Keith. James, are you there?
Yep, I'm here.
All righty. So you, since we last spoke, have decided to run for Congress.
Yes. Well, I think I was kind of deciding it when we last spoke, and some months prior to that. We were just, you know, looking for the opportunity to win, or the right aligning of the stars, and we think that we've stumbled on that now in the 13th District of New York, just given the political climate and the current incumbent and the list of issues that we think we can bring to light and actually write into policy. So the world is working in our favor, and so yes, I'm running on behalf of a large coalition of activist groups and corporations and trade groups and individuals and thinkers who want to move the country in a more progressive way economically and socially.
Now, New York's 13th District is currently held by a Democrat. What is your opinion of the policies and the performance of the current holder of that office?
Yeah, so the incumbent is a Democrat. He's been in office about 12 months now. And he's...
How do you pronounce his last name?
Espaillat. So okay. Adriano Espaillat is the current incumbent. And he won after the retiring of a long-term incumbent named Charlie Rangel. And Charlie was in the U.S. Congress for about 40 years. And just finally retired, and it was a dense race in 2016, and a lot of the previous enclaves were divided by, you know, multiple ambitious candidates, and Adriano was able to stick it out and win with just over 30% of the vote. And but aside from that, you know, it's a heavily Democratic district. Actually, this is considered the second most progressive voting district in the country. I was shocked to
wow.
find that out myself. I thought that it would be somewhere in California or somewhere further northeast up where you are. But we are number two, and the first most progressive district is out here in the Bronx in the 15th. And so aside from that, our incumbent right now, in my opinion, I think the majority of the Democrats' opinion in the area is a conservative. His inaction on policy and his silence on social and human rights issues and his hawkishness on real estate and gentrification just really signal how, you know, relatively conservative he is in this hyper-progressive district. So we're running left of him, and I like to use the word we, even though everyone keeps telling me to say I more. Maybe I'll settle into that. You know, I've been playing politics for quite a while, but it's the first time that I'm running, and so I'm trying to get used to the idea of myself as the politician, or using that title as one of my own. But, yeah, so we think he's a conservative, and he's done a lot of racist, sexist, and homophobic, and just anti, you know, human rights and community focused things in his past. He's been a politician for 30 years, so he's by no means a new alternative to the 40-year incumbent. And we just think it's time for not just change, but real opportunities to come to people. And we just don't think that he has the chops to identify what opportunities look like in his 60s here in New York.
So what are some specific policies that you and your campaign will use to appeal to the District 13 constituents?
Well, yeah, so we have a group of policies that I like to call the progressive cake. I mean, we attack the three cornerstones in affordable housing, healthcare, and education, which are, at least when we survey folks, what we find that they care about the most. But I think the undertone from my candidacy is really economic inclusion. We don't think that our incumbent or really anybody else across the United States has the skill set or the wisdom to bring forth policies that really get to the girth of the iceberg that is the economic inequality gap. And so I think last time we talked about personal data, we talked about basic income, we talked about quite a few things with regards to economics. And I think the most interesting thing to me that's happened over the course of the past 2 years since the beginning of the last presidential campaign is that there's a real conversation right now about economic inequality that just hasn't existed, in the United States definitely in the past four decades or my whole lifetime. So since the 70s. And we think we've identified a new asset class to better distribute wealth in general, and that is personal data, which is the core topic that I care about in my day job, or I guess in my old day job. And we're looking at every individual's personal data as an asset class that we can establish legal rights for their ownership so that we can better distribute value to them, so that we can better distribute wealth from the productivity that is the corporate productivity of our economy. And so per our ability to do that, we think through policy and through legislation, we think that we have the potential to refund programs in that progressive cake, housing, education, and healthcare, that have been depleted over the course of the past four decades. And our strategy to do that is not something that that our incumbent or, again, the party or, politicians in general, whether they're red or blue, have a good grasp on. I think that's really because they come from a technological space. And so we're here to, add some engineering savvy to modern politics.
I found that I can't repeat a guest's name often enough, and I think that's probably doubly true for you, given that you're running for office and name recognition is pretty invaluable when it comes to that. So I'm speaking with James Felton Keith, whose initials are much better for running in Congress than mine. Much better to be JFK than KMO when running for office, particularly as a Democrat. You're also the author of a book called Personal Data, The People's Asset Class. What does that phrase asset class really mean?
So, first off, great question, because I think most people don't think about it as an asset class when we initially start talking. But an asset class is just an underlying thing of value. Not to get too wonky and quote Karl Marx too much, but he was one of the early thinkers with regards to value, who established, what assets were and were not, and talking about, that they need to be something of value. So when we say personal data, the people's asset class, I'm specifically talking about that your personal data, that is your social media data, your location data, your financial data, your insurance data, and of course your healthcare data, that it is yours and it has value. And because it has value, we spend a lot of time in our regular work, and I spend a lot of time in my writings in the book talking about how that value can be transacted and how you should be indemnified more for that value. But you would need the legal right to that, which is why we're running for office. But But yeah, so the book is just establishing what this asset class is, how pervasive this asset class is, so that we can start to think about it in a more useful way as this economy transforms into what it will be. I'll tell you a quick story, something that was really interesting to me a few weeks ago that I was kind of shocked to hear. I think Ezra Klein, who started Vox, the TV platform, where they're mostly on social media, he was interviewing Hillary Clinton. And he was interviewing Hillary Clinton about her latest book, What Happened. I think that's the name of her latest book. And he just started the interview with what was most interesting to him. He said, I want to start with what's most interesting to me, and it's the fact that you almost ran your campaign on a platform of universal basic income. And she said, sure, you know, I was thinking about it, I was exploring it, and I looked at the oil patrimony that Alaskan citizens have. Now, I, you know, as, you know, someone who lives in New York and who has lived in a bunch of other places but never Alaska, I wasn't aware that they had this oil patrimony and that everyone gets a check every month for this resource that they extract from the earth. And but she said she couldn't make that model work in the other states, in the other 49 states. And I think that's because she couldn't identify, or not I think, but I know that it's because she couldn't identify the asset that we extract from individual owners in order to reallocate bulk funds to them. And I remember being very excited about that interview because it came out a bit after my book, Personal Data, the People's Asset Class, came out, because the core asset that we extract from individuals that they have an outright ownership to these days is their personal data. And it doesn't matter whether it's their data from a consumer standpoint or a medical standpoint or an employment standpoint. Every product and service that drives corporate productivity is built on people's personal data. Even if you're a project manager at, you know, some large corporation, and your contribution are texts and emails and direction to your team to drive a project forward. It is true that corporations and corporate productivity only grows either via projects or products. And so because that is true, and because we can track your input to that productivity, we can also use that data to identify what you're owed from that productive process. And so in the book, I try to dig down and make a lot of physics analogies to, you know, what your personal data is and how it is not necessarily intellectual property, but it is something, you know, more basic. It is something more, you know, intrinsic to your being. It's your contribution that you make into the world based on your experiences, your knowledge, your very being. And because that is valuable now, because we've reverse engineered everything that everyone is into zeros and ones, we can start to better allocate their value, especially as we automate traditional employment, or at least for how we knew it in the 20th century. I think this is the best new way to start to indemnify people. And quite frankly, I think it's a lot bigger than basic income. It's not very basic at all, and it's not egalitarian. It's not, you know, everyone's getting a $1,000 check every month. It's showing that, you know, some people, based on their participation, are going to be worth more than others. But it also, if we're looking at the data, we can see sorts of discrimination, whether they be gender-based or ethnic-based or other. We can start to see, you know, where productivity is stifled, where input is stifled. But I guess the core philosophy that drives all of this is that the way economists establish productivity is as a measure of input. And so as a politician, all I want to do is write policy that gives people outright ownership of their input to my productivity so that they can make a legal argument that I owe them some of the productivity, because that's what's stifling the economy right now. And that's something that no politician who's running right now can articulate in short or long form. And that's a problem. So that's the real reason that we're running, is to make this a more casual conversation, or even a more endowed conversation.
So help me understand the money-making potential for individuals on their personal data. Would the money be coming from the corporations that want to make use of that data, or is the government involved in making the payments, or how is it that an individual who gains control over this particular asset class, the digital data that they create just in their daily lives, how does that get monetized for them?
Sure. So I think using the existing banking and capital structure is so important. We have a lot of the infrastructure that we need to transact this value. And so it's not a method of paying you upfront for participation, right? I think the first things first is we have to differentiate contributions versus creation. So individuals contribute value or contribute data. And groups of individuals, call some of them corporations or institutions of sorts, they create things through multiple inpourings of data or value. And then once that creation, you know, that coming together of human experience to create some product or service is productive in a notable way, meaning some consumer has gobbled it up and we've banked that value, saying that we're placing a dollar on the shelf in a bank account somewhere, then we can look back at that banked value to say what of this is owed to the inputs of this value, of this productivity, excuse me. I think that's the method that we have to use. And in executing that method, which is, again, in a shorter form, is input is given from individuals. And as it is given from individuals, it creates productivity. And as productivity is acknowledged and banked, then we can redistribute that productivity to the people who were inputs to that productivity. Now, in facilitating that, corporations, you know, if they're wise, they'll see it as an opportunity to better indemnify people who participate in their productivity. You know, government institutions can act as an intermediary. They can act as an intermediary in a few different ways. But, you know, the way that they used to do that was through taxes. But even though I think some folks would argue that we collect quite a lot of taxes at the moment, I mean, when we look at the past four decades, or when we look at the end of the 70s to now, we don't collect as much taxes as we used to. If we look at the past 50 years, we don't collect nearly as many taxes as we used to. And as a result, we failed to fund all the programs that prop up the people who have been left out of the productivity equation. Quite frankly, people just don't have an ownership stake in the productivity that exists, and so we can't find a way to pay them. And wages just simply aren't enough per our perception of what they're doing. Wages act as more of a retainer for people's time so they can give us as much of their input to our productivity as possible. And so I think governments can interact on bonus structure from the productivity that exists at the corporate level to ensure that the majority of the productivity that is identifiable can be distributed back to the rightful owners of the input to that productivity. Or corporations can do it directly. And I think it depends on corporation to corporation. As a policy advocate and a policy maker, because we've written a lot of the personal data policies that exist around the globe and influenced others, I think it is not my job to place a rigid value on what people get, but it is my job to facilitate their legal right to have a negotiation. And so we think the best way to facilitate these negotiations are to give people outright ownerships of their input to productivity so that they can be better advocates, whether they're on their own or whether they're in a group like a labor union, or whether they're leveraging a local or state or national government to advocate on their behalf so that they can get their just due from the economic productivity around them. And it's all around them. You know, it's not just in the places that they work, but it's also in the places that they influence. It's also in the places that they're coined as consumers. You know, some of the value in these places is nominal, but it adds up over time. And that's the point, is that as we become more productive, we need to understand that, you know, people are providing the core value that we're generating productivity from, that we derive all of our value from other individuals. And if we adopt that core idea as a species, as a nation, then I think we'll do a better job of distributing the value that exists to ensure that the places that we exist are worth existing in. I need to work on using a different word there, but anyway, that's where we are.
Well, let me ask you to flesh that general explanation out with a specific hypothetical example of somebody who generates data just in the course of their life. That data gets used by some entity and monetized, and then that person gets some, you know, quantifiable monetary value in return.
Sure. So I think the marketing example is the easiest example, because at some sense, or at the core, all of these transactions come down to, you know, some form of marketing. So I would say think about the person who, you know, I talked to a real estate company. I think this is a good, more recent example, who owns the majority of the real estate in Times Square on Broadway. And their IT director was telling me about how they just turned the Wi-Fi on for free for everyone, and how they're making more money on the Wi-Fi than it cost them initially to build out, you know, this infrastructure. They're making kind of 70% a year on that initial investment. And it's because they sell the personal data that they track from their patrons. So if you're a, you know, French or British tourist, you're in New York for the weekend or the week or whatever, and you're taking in a show, and I am tracking this data on you because you're using my free network, and I sell that record from your usage or those records from your usage to a data broker. Data brokers are companies like Axiom or WPP owns a few there. There are hundreds of them, and they, you know, line Madison Ave where marketing companies used to be. And so they'll buy those records for $15 a record. And to put it into perspective for you, a record is really just any two things about you on a spreadsheet, on a column in a row. So your last name and your email address. And so the data broker has that record, your last name and email address, and he'll, you know, add it to any other records that he has on you. But every time he acquires a record, that's sort of the standard fee, around $15 plus or minus a bit. And then he'll sell that record to interested parties in a process called the amendments process. So if I am Macy's, a large department store, I may have your last name and your physical address, but I want your email address as well. So I want them to match it. I want them to amend my record with theirs, and I'll pay them 50 cents every time they make an amendment properly. And so they'll run, you know, my records against all their records to see what they have, and I'll pay them out. And then part of that, I will start to email you or micro-target you, say, on your social media or somewhere else, because I have information about you. And I know that you bought a shirt at some point and had it shipped to your mailing address, or you paid with a check or whatever. And now I'll start to hit you with, you know, more adverts about sales that you might like in the future. And so that microeconomy exists based on that initial $15 buy. Now, the individual whose personal data that was is probably, arguably, and I would argue that they are, owed more than 50% of that initial $15 buy and the 50-cent amendment. Now, in a negotiation, they might be, you know, they might be beat out for a little bit less, or they might win a little bit more. And I think that it, you know, that capitalistic, you know, the availability of a process to, you know, for someone to represent themselves and create a boat of competition to accrue as much capital as they can, that should be allowed to happen. It's the American way, but it's also what has proven to work All the empirical evidence supports that over the course of the past 500 years. And so, but that's the economy. So it's about $15 a record. But that's just in that space. In other spaces, if we get into pharmaceuticals and healthcare data, the price for records is much higher. The price for records in closed use cases to look at tissue samples or to look at workflow experiences, if we're just talking about in physical spaces like hospitals, in physical spaces like corporations or neighborhoods, is quite a bit more high. And we can even identify this by the fact that I was riding in a Juno, which is a ride-sharing app similar to Uber, the other day, and the driver tells me that they insist on having their drivers keep the app on in sort of airplane mode or dormant mode when they're not driving. And they're pulling data on all that. I have another, source at one of those companies, at a company called Git, who acquired Juno, who says that, yeah, they're tracking all that data to derive patterns. They want to know more about the kind of people who are their drivers, and they also want to know, about the driver and the driving record. But I'm also assuming that those records would be attractive to anyone building autonomous vehicle platforms. I'm assuming it would be attractive to law enforcement. I'm assuming it would also be attractive to the automotive industry and a myriad of other industries to understand, how we move. But yeah, so those are some of the economics around what your data is worth and how it should be funneled back, or how it could be, funneled back to you after it is recognized as something that is productive or something that is valuable.
Well, something you mentioned earlier, which I think the example that you gave really makes clear, is that not everybody's data is equally valuable. So somebody who logs in, somebody who lives, say, in London, and it's been observed that they log into Wi-Fi at the airport in Singapore two or three times a year, their data is going to be worth a lot more than mine. Somebody who lives in rural Vermont and who logs into the free Wi-Fi at Subway a couple times a week. Mm-hmm. It kind of seems like this would be exacerbating disparities between, the wealthy and the poor.
Sure. So there's always the potential that disparities can increase, but there's never the potential, in my opinion, that disparities can be decreased unless we're making a more logical, a more ethical argument. And so I think what the immediate data shows, like if we could pull a data point on every piece of matter, everything in physical existence right now, right, we would notice all kinds of jaw-dropping disparities, right, immediately. And as time goes on, we could certainly extrapolate or speculate about how they could expand. But I think the core reason to advocate for this sort of data collection to continue is because it is the only way that people who are on the receiving less is the only way to advocate for them to get, their just due and to better involve them in the economy as it exists around them. Because you're absolutely right. Some people's data is worth more than others. But I think, first things first, I'm never saying that, the guy who sleeps on the subway is more valuable than you, or that you are more valuable, or that your influence that there is that it's more valuable than Beyonce's, right? But I am saying that the guy who sleeps on the subway is not worth less. I think we want to start there, because there are plenty of people out here who thinks that he is. And so we can first say that we know for a fact that that guy is not worth less. We want to know about his life. And then we want to figure out, so we let that be first. I think then the growth from that is to try and understand how we better involve him in the ecosystem around him. I mean, we could call it the economy, we could call it the society, we could call it the community. But the reality is, and I think, again, all the empirical evidence shows that the more people who participate in an economy, the better it is. but there will be some standouts, because ultimately what we're measuring here is influence. And all we're talking about right now are social settings, but there are other settings where someone who seems a lot more down and out, their data may be wildly more valuable than ours because of what they're exposed to. So if we're looking at the influence of illness per people who sleep outside versus people who sleep inside, or illness, you know, per people who, you know, have a certain sort of diet depending on, you know, what part of the world that they live in, et cetera, we want massive amounts of information about that so that we can understand how to either prop up what is good or protect us from what is bad. And so I think the truth is that everyone has something unique to share, and personal data is not just this sort of marketing data that we see in the immediately interconnected world, but it's everything that's being pulled from us. You know, even I think, you know, the insurance industry probably shows some of the hugest gaps in data and value. And we can just look at how people of different backgrounds and different geographies, of different ethnicities and different genders are considered with regards to risk. And after we understand how those folks are considered with regards to risk, we can start to, if they are in fact more risky, figure out ways to lower that risk by bundling them or supporting them or pouring more resources into them to ensure they're less risky. Or if it's just blatant discrimination, we can look at how we remedy that, you know, what they may be even owed in some situations. So, again, every sort of institution is a data company now. And because it is the core resource, it has to be at the core of what we use to indemnify people for their participation in the economy and start to build on equality. I mean, the main reason I'm running for U.S. Congress is because I don't think that this is a fix-all or a catch-all, you know, day one. It's not that transactional. But we need another few decades to build out the infrastructure of how we transact value to start to value people again and pour back into the economy that we've really depleted. And, you know, I think we're seeing the effects of that here in the United States right now. And it could get pretty dire if we let this run on for another 40 years, especially considering, you know, what else is going on in the world.
You are listening to WOOL-FM 91.5 Bellows Falls, Black Sheep Radio. I am KMO, the host of Sea Realm Radio, and I'm speaking with James Felton Keith, otherwise known as JFK. He is running for Congress, and we are talking about basically giving people control over an asset that they generate just by being alive in the digital age, and that is the personal data that they create and that companies aggregate and sell to advertisers and make lots of money from. James, if you are going to be running, if you're going to make a successful run for Congress, you need to have a high tolerance for repeating yourself, and you have to have a simple message. You need to be able to describe these complex terms in a very brief, succinct way. So let me ask you to sum up what you've been saying for the past half hour as quickly and as snappily as you can.
Sure. So all we're saying in our core message, our core platform, is that people are valuable, and that they're more valuable in a community, and that the opportunity from that community is in how we establish ownership for them to participate in the economy. That's really all. It's not a basic income message per se, even though I like some of the language around basic income. And it's not only an economic message, but we're trying to tie in the idea of human value to the idea of economic ownership. And we think it will require, at least in our district, of about 750,000 residents, a lot of small conversations, 5-minute conversations, to, number one, educate people that this asset class exists, but that they don't have ownership rights over it right now, unless some new legislation comes down the pipeline. And so we end up talking about whatever their regular social issues are. And this is where the campaign actually happens. You know, we don't go around talking about the undertone of personal data, but we all end up always getting to it as we pursue the different issues of the day. So in some places, education is, you know, a hot button issue for constituents. In other places, healthcare is a hot button issue. And I think all across New York, affordable housing is a hot button issue. And people want to know, you know, how do they bring down the price of the rent? And how do they ensure that they'll be able to exist here? You know, people want to know that someone's going to advocate for their basic right to exist. And we start at, you know, a core philosophy of the fact that they have this intrinsic value, and that they should own it, and so that they should also have an ownership stake in everything else that happens around them. That is the healthcare infrastructure, the housing infrastructure, and the education infrastructure. So the campaign itself is different. I guess we've differentiated it a bit from the ideas of personal data and the new book and democracy. I think politics is just about winning. And the democracy conversation, which is one that we're having right here, is more about big ideas and how do we drive politics to make sure that our quality of lives are sustainable. But I've run on, and yeah, the core message of the campaign is that people in their communities are valuable, and that we have a new opportunity for them. So we're telling them that we have a new opportunity, you know, in store for them, and we're waiting for their ask of, you know, what is it? How does it work for me? Obviously, knowing when we come into certain groups, certain communities, that they have core issues that they want to talk about. They usually fall into one of those buckets: healthcare, education, or housing. But we derive the opportunity from that core place, and I think that having this core philosophy helps us pivot and make derive a variety of policy solutions for their different situations. So yeah, that's the difficult part.
Keith, earlier you mentioned the Alaska Permanent Fund, which is the closest thing that exists in the United States to universal basic income. The value of the annual payout varies dramatically depending on how the assets that this fund draws from to make the payments performs in a given year. So the least it's ever paid out is something in the realm of $300. And the most it's ever paid out is just a little over $2,000 for a year, not nearly enough for anybody to live on.
Right.
When it comes to, I mean, the UBI or universal basic income discussion, it seems more popular than ever. And I think a lot of that is because a lot of people on the right, and particularly in Silicon Valley, you know, the sort of California libertarians who tend to be pretty progressive on social issues, but then, you know, when it comes to money, less so. There is a brand of UBI that is popular in those circles. But that UBI is completely different from the UBI that is popular on the left. On the left, people see it as a way to increase social spending, you know, to in addition to Medicare and Medicaid and housing vouchers and food stamps and, you know, all the other targeted aid programs. You know, this is something extra to give people some dignity and some options and to allow them to refuse exploitative work. But on the right, people use that exact same phrase, UBI, to mean a complete replacement of all of those targeted programs. All of those programs, means-tested and you know, need-based programs, go away. And in exchange, everybody, you know, millionaire to pauper alike, gets the same check every month. And, you know, maybe you can take back the millionaire's payment with higher taxes, but,
sure,
you know, taxes on the top bracket seem to be going the other way these days. So I have heard it argued that really what UBI does, particularly this right-wing brand of UBI, is take money from the truly needy in order to give it to everybody. And there's obvious problems with that. So let me have you comment on just this equivocation that goes on, that the UBI gets referred to a lot, but it means two completely different things.
Well, right. It's in fact, I think, you know, the libertarian view of UBI is quite cruel, and I think a certain amount of privilege has to exist for someone to be, you know, a true libertarian. You know, I argue even with one of my former employees about this, who's a trader. A trader, like he trades the the equity markets. He's not a
good
trader.
Save.
But right. He's a financial analyst. But I think it's quite cruel, and you're right. It takes away the programs that the truly needy need to give a check to everybody. And I think that's why I really don't like, I'm not a huge fan of either one of the methodologies of UBI. I'll say, because I think a little bit more context is necessary to properly answer the question. I do think from a marketing standpoint, because we are talking about politics, right? So things have to be politically palpable in order for us to pass laws to achieve any of these economic goals. And I think we've passed the point of being able to make a good argument on behalf of taxes. The hyper-conservatives have done a great job of marketing over the course of the past 40 years and that taxes are a bad thing. So it doesn't matter whether you're rich or poor or liberal or conservative or anything else, you don't think that taxes are a great thing and you don't want to pay them. So I think that at this point in time, I think we should always be conscious over time that another political revolution can come into play, like, you know, the neocons in the late 70s and early 80s, that could stifle our ability to generate revenues from taxes. And so we should not only rely on those. But anyway, we're in that place right now where we absolutely cannot rely on those. So I think it's false to assume that we'll be able to recoup, higher UBI from higher earners who get one of these checks. So on top of that, I think that what I'm proposing by this outright ownership policy of people's personal data is, as these systems, as data proliferates and these systems come into more play, I think that we want to give more individuals and groups of individuals the opportunity to negotiate their value with whoever is the banker or controller of that value. And it's not representative of just one fund. And, I think it's representative of, you know, every institution that exists is ideally a fund. So every bank account for every institution that is productive as a result of human input, even if it comes from some form of AI or, you know, synthetic intelligence, or whatever the core term that people are using right now, you know, what created that was something that was human. I think it's necessary to establish that everything that exists, every methodology, every hardware, and every software that exists in the known world is an extension of humanity. And so they should all, as they are productive, pour back into and prop up the livelihoods of humanity. And so when we apply that to UBI, I do think that public programs that, you know, help the needy should be expanded. That's why I'm a fan of government, even though, you know, I think what people will formally call a free market capitalist. But what's happening right now is another brand of cronyism. It's not capitalism at all. And I think if we're going to facilitate capitalism or be able to transact capital in a good way and in a scalable way, then we have to identify more owners with more ownership rights of the capital. And I think that's the fundamental change that has to happen in order for us to be able to distribute any sort of UBI. But to your earlier question, I think that the leftist UBI is more attractive than the libertarian UBI that we see out in California. I think that people are too oversold on the idea that they are self-made, you know, whether they're getting their ideas from Ben Franklin's self-made man or, you know, Tupac's self-made millionaire, whoever the hell they're listening to, it's ridiculous. And I think it has to be a big piece of our political lexicon that we're talking about that the only value that we really have are interactions with other people and the community that we create, that it is the core economic driver. And we see that in cities. We see that when we come into more dense spaces, we are more productive, the economy scales, and that only from that can we better distribute basic incomes or income in general to people. So I think with more resources, again, which is while we're running for U.S. Congress, I think it's possible to rebrand some of these ideas and make them more digestible for the masses. But you know, you got to start somewhere. And you know, a part of this is the snowball effect of getting into politics and figuring out what you can brand, you know, in your locale, and then you scale into what you can brand in your state, and then what you can brand nationally. But even though this conversation is about universal basic income and it has some context, the vast majority of people don't know what basic income is. And I think if surveyed, and this is just me making an assumption, I think most people would reject the idea of what basic income is, because even though people use words like dignity around it, it seems like it has no dignity. The first term is not very dignified, and it feels right into the old terminology of welfare, and no one wants to be the welfare recipient. People want to be acknowledged as valuable, and the dignity comes from knowing that you are valuable, and knowing it in a factual third-party way really helps. Saying, I don't know that I'm valuable because I think that I'm valuable, but I know that I am valuable because it is written. It is on a spreadsheet.
Or
somewhere.
My value is reflected in the paycheck that I receive from this corporation, which clearly has some use for me. Otherwise, they wouldn't give me this money and keep me around.
Well, sure. Well, even when we think about that, even when we think about you know, the corporate dollars that are being spent, you know, I was just reading, you know, some reports from I can't remember where these economists were from at this point, because I'm taking in so much data from folks lately, but. Sure, people identified or they, you know, they derived their dignity from what they received from corporations, and sure, some people still do that, but it's increasingly less. I think that's the thing. I think the turnover rate in general in corporate America, outside of the really creative positions, these are your product designers, product managers, and your managers, directors, and executives. People who are outside of that class of professional experience a high turnover rate, like plus 65% of them don't want to be working where they are. And it's because they feel undervalued or under-challenged, or they're not using their core skill sets or what they care about. And it's because the way the world previously worked was in a very transactional way. I pay you for your time. You come here, you do a thing, you clock in, you clock out, and you're gone. And you could plateau easily. You could achieve some sense of sustainability in your career without retooling so regularly. But the world doesn't work like that anymore. And now I think what's really most valuable about corporations are that they're able to pull even more information from their employees sometimes than they're pulling from their consumers, and they understand what needs to change even faster. And so there's these sort of hybrid teams bouncing around surveying the surveyors and facilitating all the corporate change management. And it makes everyone else really more of a resource or an asset class than the producer that they would traditionally think themselves to be. And as a result, they're undervalued, so they're underpaid. You know, if you automate away a few positions and you bring someone back in to monitor a process that you previously automated, you'll likely pay them less than you pay the old guy. I know that was how my career started. When I started my career as a professional engineer, not an engineer in training, I think I was 23, and I was replacing a guy who was there for 32 years, and I'm sure he was a lot more expensive than I. I'm not sure exactly what he made. I just know he had a couple of homes, and I only had one. And I made $25 an hour as a contractor. with no stake on the company, no insurance, no health care, no any of that stuff. And, you know, I was a custodian of a process that had essentially been built around this older resource. And I was a part of the change management team's product portfolio, even though I was a human designing mechanical products for this company. So yeah, I don't think that dignity, it's not sustainable to think that dignity will come from jobs alone in the future, because payment definitely won't come from those places. And it's also not sustainable, I don't think, to assume that dignity will come from a check, a check that comes out of nowhere. You know, dignity only comes from knowing that dignity really isn't about income at all. You know, it's about understanding that you are a valuable participant in the community around you. And so we have to start there. It has to be something sort of deeper than economics that fuels our economic transactions. And terms like basic just won't do it.
Keith, we're going to have to wrap up here in a couple minutes. Let me change the subject just a little bit and say that I'm looking at your Facebook page right now, and the banner that you have at the top of the page is advertising the second annual Youth March Against Police Brutality. And you've got the big hashtag Future of the City. This is next Saturday from noon to 5, and the address gets cut off, but I think it says 515 Malcolm X Boulevard. Would you talk about why, you know, what this event is? I mean, the name certainly communicates something, and also why it's at the top of your Facebook page.
Well, yeah, so it's at the top of the Facebook page just to draw attention, because we are going to be corralling at the corner of 135th Street and Malcolm X Boulevard, which is 6th Avenue, up here in Harlem, and we're going to march to the Museum of Natural History on the west side from about 12 p.m. to 5 p.m. And the march is really about, you know, dignity. As I and the other partners who are putting together this event, like Rise and Resist and the South Bronx Community Charter High School and Black Lives Matter of Greater New York, when we travel around the city and we talk to, you know, really young people, you know, school-age people, about what they think about themselves, what they think about the areas that they live in, a lot of them communicate back that they feel as though they're living in a policed place or a policed state. And this march is the second annual march. We had about 1,000 people marching last year, and we expect to beat that by at least 4 times this year. But this march is really just about drawing attention to these young people's lives who matter, and it's also about drawing attention to the fact that police brutality and adjacent sorts of, you know, brutality have an adverse effect on increasingly younger people, because it's so transparent now. So even while it is true that we live in a more robust, more peaceful place than we ever have, it is also true that everything that is wrong with this place is transparent now. There's data on it. And the visualization of everything that is wrong, you know, with these places that we live in has an adverse effect on these young people's identities, their confidence, their ability to participate and be influential in the world. And so we're marching to draw awareness to that. And, you know, we're trying to pull in as many even, you know, political figures and leaders and decision makers as possible, so that we can keep this at the top of our mind when we design policies. You know, we have to make the human rights issue the core of all of our other issues, or else we're failing the people around us, and we're failing ourselves. So that's why it's up there.
I was living in New York City when Bill de Blasio was elected mayor, and it seemed as though in the campaign he was standing up or promising to stand up to the NYPD and rein them in, because they are gaining, I think, deservedly a reputation for being really heavy-handed and overbearing, particularly with young people of color on the street. What has been your impression of Mayor de Blasio in his, well, his delivery of that implied promise?
So, well, with his delivery of that, like I said, implied promise. So I think what he did that was good was he got rid of stop and frisk in the way that Mayor Bloomberg used it. But it is a culture, and it is something that I think, you know, corporate change management, which, you know, the NYPD is a lot, rather large corporation of individuals, takes time to pivot. And so I would say on his ability to get rid of the toxic culture that was magnified by stop and frisk, he did a good job. But there's so much more to be done in training, and not just you know, operational training, but also cultural and culturally sensitive training, and also recruiting, that I do not think that he's done a great job at. So they could do a lot more in engaging these communities to really pull officers from these communities onto the force. And, you know, I think, I know that, you know, politicians' terms are short, and that, you know, the next guy or woman who wins doesn't always have the same ideas in place, but they have to set in a sort of corporate culture that is going to be more than transactional, about engaging community, taking in their greatest fears, and then making them owners of remedying those great fears. I think the biggest problem in American politics and city politics today is that politicians come into play making a promise that they can wave a wand and fix things for you, instead of empowering you to fix these things with them. Because it's hard work. They don't, you know, a lot of folks don't want to do that very hard groundwork. And so that's why I think he can do a whole lot better. Because, well, people still feel threatened.
James Felton Keith, I think we'll have to wrap it up there and leave off. I think that was a pretty optimistic line to end on. But let me invite you to share contact information or websites or anything else that you'd like to leave with people.
Sure, yeah. So everyone can reach me at www.votejfk.org. That's votejfk.org. And all my email and phone number and the team is, they're all there. And all of the events that we're hosting are there, and we will respond. We are constantly on the web.
All righty. Well, thank you very much for calling in, and I look forward to our next conversation.
Thank you.
All right, everybody. That was James Felton Keith. Again, votejfk.org to find out more. There is more to be read, but the time is gone. So you can find this and all of our announcements at blacksheepradio.org/wool. Look for the Mid-River Bulletin Board. All right, that is all for this episode of CROM Radio. Thanks so much for listening, and stay well.